The Legion is transferring to another school, but he didn't say which one. Head coach Bruce Weber described Legion as a good kid who worked hard and gave great effort. Legion, who is from Detroit, played 33 games for the Illini, totaling 107 points. He scored a career-high 15 points last year against Michigan State and had a season-high 11 points against Presbyterian on November 21st. The Illini open Big Ten play tomorrow against 25th-ranked Northwestern. New Orleans has the top seed in the NFC heading into the playoffs. The Saints clinched home field advantage after the Vikings lost in Chicago to the Bears last night in overtime. The score of that game, 36-30. Embattled coach Vinny Del Negro takes the Chicago Bulls into a home game with the Indiana Pacers tonight. The Bulls are coming off one of their best games of the season on Saturday, beating New Orleans. The Pacers have dropped six straight. The Central Division leading Chicago Blackhawks play in Dallas tonight. The Stars beat the Hawks in Chicago in their only meeting so far this season. That one snapped a four-game Chicago winning streak. And the St. Louis Blues, they have the NHL's worst home record heading into tonight's matchup with the Nashville Predators in St. Louis. The Predators lost two straight to Chicago over the weekend to fall 8 points behind the Blackhawks in the Central Division. St. Louis and Nashville have split two games this season. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting audiences with an exciting January schedule of events featuring the Moscow Festival Ballet, Kronos Quartet with Wu Man, and Michael Rouse. More information can be found online at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:42. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio. WILL is a listener-supported broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Engineers yesterday dynamited the massive Crown Point Bridge that links Vermont and New York across Lake Champlain. The 80-year-old bridge was closed without warning last fall because of safety concerns. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann has the story.
Old newsreel footage from 1929 shows then New York Governor Franklin Roosevelt mugging for cameras as the ribbon was cut at the center of the Crown Point Bridge.
The opening of the bridge was a truly momentous historic event, and the communities on both sides of the lake turned out to see it.
The moment was included as part of a documentary produced by the Lake Champlain Maritime Museum. The graceful arched metal trusses became a fixture on the landscape here, set against the backdrop of the Adirondack Mountains. But for years, locals complained that the bridge seemed to be falling apart. Robin Reed is a dairy farmer from Charlotte, Vermont.
My son drove his tractor over here to spread some manure earlier this year, and he said, I looked down and I could see the rebar. And this was before they closed it. And he said, I'm not going over that thing again.
Then this fall, Ted Zolli, a consultant working for New York's Transportation Department, found that the cement foundations under the bridge were literally rotting away.
As we poured into the piers, some 3 or 4 feet, the outside 18 inches just crumbled in your hands.
The bridge was closed abruptly in mid-October, disrupting the lives of thousands of people in the Champlain Valley, who often live and work on opposite shores. Locals were infuriated by 100-mile detours, convinced that state officials had neglected the old bridge, allowing it to decay without proper maintenance. This folk song has been circulating on YouTube.
Oh, they say it ain't safe anymore.
It ain't safe!
Yeah, the state spent all our money on stuff they shouldn't have spent it for. While the pilings are all rotten, simple maintenance was forgotten. Ineptitude.
State engineers insist that the cement pilings deteriorated much faster than anyone could have anticipated. But in a briefing before Monday's blast, lead project engineer John Grady acknowledged that the structure was so unstable, they actually had to use more explosives to ensure a clean demolition.
We'll have somewhere over 500 linear shape charges on the bridge. That's over 800 pounds of explosives. It's going to be loud.
A few minutes after 10 a.m. yesterday morning, the warning whistle sounded. Then Vermont Governor Jim Douglas pushed the detonator button, triggering a sudden tremor and a rip of white light. The steel trusses dissolved into blue-gray smoke, with sections of metal tipping slowly down through a snow squall. Tons of concrete and steel sent a surge of water sweeping across the ice-covered lake. State officials say a new span will be in place by the summer of 2011, And despite lingering resentment over the loss of this historic bridge, local leaders say they're pleased with the pace of the project. With temperatures here expected to plunge into the single digits this week, workers have already begun hoisting the tangled wreckage onto barges so it can be hauled away for scrap. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in Westport, New York.
The last 10 years have seen the emergence of an entirely new branch of biomedical research. Therapies based on human embryonic stem cells seem promising for treating a number of diseases. But as NPR's Joe Pelka reports, stem cell research has been controversial, and the story of funding this research is a tangled one.
Embryonic stem cells have remarkable properties. They can grow indefinitely in the lab, and they can turn into any cell type in the body. But to get them, you must destroy an embryo. Scientists first showed that it was possible to grow human embryonic stem cells in 1998. Under normal circumstances, other scientists would have rushed in to study the new cells. But there was a problem. Because of congressional restrictions, federal money couldn't be used for research that harms an embryo. President Bill Clinton interpreted that to mean scientists could use federal money to study embryonic stem cells once they were growing in the lab, provided they used private money to create them. But before President Clinton's decision took effect, George W. Bush became president. One of his first acts as president was to put that decision on hold so he could reconsider it. In August 2001, the new president decided that despite his finding the research morally troubling,
I have concluded that we should allow federal funds to be used for research on these existing stem cell lines, where the life and death decision has already been made.
The existing stem cell lines turned out to be a dozen or so lines that had already been made using non-federal dollars. They were made from embryos that would have been discarded by fertility clinics. The decision pleased no one. Scientists were upset by the restrictions. Critics of the research were upset the president had allowed any federal money to be spent on embryonic stem cells. Both sides went to work to change the policy. A bipartisan Congress voted to ease federal restrictions. President Bush vetoed the legislation. Congressional opponents continued to push for a total ban on the research, and states got into the fray. In California, voters authorized spending $3 billion over 10 years for embryonic stem cell research. Candidate Barack Obama promised to ease the Bush administration's restrictions, a promise President Obama made good on in March.
Today, with the executive order I am about to sign, we will bring the change that so many scientists and researchers, doctors and innovators, patients and loved ones have hoped for and fought for these past 8 years. We will lift the ban on federal funding for promising embryonic stem cell research.
Of course, it wasn't really a ban, just restrictions. But the scientists attending Mr. Obama's speech were clearly jubilant. So where does all the political to-ing and fro-ing leave the research?
Well, I think we're into an exciting period of time.
Len Zahn is a stem cell researcher at Children's Hospital in Boston. He says there's a lot of exciting basic research being done with embryonic stem cells, but using them to treat patients?
I think that's still a ways off. Although there are some initial studies that the FDA is considering, I think we still need to figure out how to make these cells at a more efficient and effective way. And I think that's going to take still a while. You know, you have to remember the stem cell field is only about 10 years old at this moment.
Zahn points out it's frequently 2 decades or more before new medical technologies find their way into patients. More immediate, Zahn thinks, is finding new drug therapies using a technique made possible by a Japanese researcher named Shinya Yamanaka. He found a way to take ordinary skin cells and turn them into cells that behave just like embryonic stem cells, but without destroying an embryo. The new technique gives scientists unprecedented abilities. For example, they can take cells from a patient with a disease and convert them into these embryonic stem cell-like cells that can grow indefinitely in the lab. Zahn thinks this will change the way scientists understand diseases.
I think that it's going to be possible in certain cases to alter the disease itself with chemicals.
And if a particular chemical can repair disease cells in the lab, then it may be possible to turn that chemical into a drug to treat patients. But even though these new cells offer great promise, Zahn says research using cells derived from human embryos is still essential.
Because these new stem cells from the skin have to be compared to a golden standard, and the golden standard is the embryonic stem cells.
So for the time being, at least, scientists will continue to do research on embryonic stem cells, now in a more permissive environment. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
This phrase has increasingly defined consumers' relationship to the entertainment industry over the past decade. Get what you want, when you want it. Is that costing us a sense of shared culture? NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Remember the Seinfeld episode when a reporter mistakenly thought that Jerry and George were lovers?
We knew you were eavesdropping. That's why my friend said all that. It was on purpose. We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
And not that there's anything wrong with it if you didn't see the episode or any of the other famous ones, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Even if you didn't see them, you knew about them.
That's Clifford Nass, Stanford University communications professor. He says Seinfeld, a show about nothing, actually meant something. Americans laughed together.
That's really what marks cultural touchstones, things that people are aware of, that they can share, that they can make reference to, that they don't actually have to consume themselves.
More than 40% of American households saw the final episode of Seinfeld in the spring of 1998, according to the Nielsen Company. Fast forward about 11 years.
The winner of American Idol 2009 is Chris Allen!
You can be forgiven if you have no idea who Chris Allen is. American Idol may be the most popular program on television today, but only about 16% of American households saw this year's finale. Over the last decade, the number of television channels has more than doubled. There's Lifetime for women, Spike for men, the Sci-Fi Channel, and onto that, the internet and YouTube. Professor Abigail Dukosnik with UC Berkeley's Center for New Media says once the nation shared trusted anchors like Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings, now everyone can find the news that suits their taste.
Fox News will take a stance that represents a certain set of values, and The Daily Show will take a stance that has a very different ideology than Fox News. For better or for worse, when we did have 60 million people watching any one network's nightly news program, that meant that 60 million people had to all receive the same information and make up their minds about it and be in dialogue with one another about it.
Dukosnik says people watch the news they find agreeable, and then they use the internet to chat with the people who share their tastes and opinions. Stanford professor Clifford Nass says social scientists find the current trends worrisome.
There have never been cultures or societies in which there weren't a very large set of shared ideas, norms, values, stories, cultures, etc. We've just never seen that before.
Of course, having a mainstream culture also meant that some people felt left out.
I'm Kenna Fung, and I'm kind of a nerd.
A science fiction nerd. Fung particularly loves the BBC program Doctor Who, which airs on cable in the U.S. Doctor Who is an alien who travels through time and space. He often visits Earth.
I'm the Doctor, by the way.
Astrid, sir. Astrid Pith.
Nice to meet you, Astrid. Merry Christmas.
Doctor Who didn't interest anyone else in school, says Fung.
Even though I know they had a lot of viewers across the world and across the country, nobody at school was really into it, and so I felt like I was the only one who liked that, and I had nobody to talk about it with.
At least not in person. But she did meet people through online fan sites.
How have you been?
I've been fine, thanks.
Fung met Mary Bister online. The two of them have never met in person. I suggested Fung give her a ring, and they had no problem launching into a conversation about the new actor who will play Doctor Who.
I can't wait to see if Matt Smith has any weird facial expressions just like David Tennant did.
Well, don't you think he has to with that face?
In the real world, this friendship between 35-year-old Bister, a medical student at the University of Chicago, and 19-year-old Fung, a community college student in San Mateo, would be unlikely.
I don't have a whole lot of young adult, late teens, early 20s friends, but in the Doctor Who fandom, that's a big percentage of who's there.
Clearly, these kinds of connections cross bridges between people in ways that watching Seinfeld or the evening news at home never could. But Stanford professor Clifford Nass says they're not likely to hold a nation together.
The things that tend to glue society together are people who share a number of things together. It makes it easier to mobilize, to bring people together behind a cause, behind an issue.
Like healthcare or war. There were decades when if you hadn't heard of certain cultural touchstones like Seinfeld or Michael Jackson, you might be considered to be living under a rock. But as technology lets each of us indulge our personal desires and tastes, we now can crawl under our own rocks. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Lisa Mullins. Events that affect your life the most often take place far from home. In financial markets, from London to Hong Kong, in war zones halfway around the globe, and in political negotiations that can change the course of history. That's why PRI's The World brings you a global view of the day's events. Join us on PRI's The World.
Monday through Friday afternoons at 3.
Earth and Sky.
Today we're speaking with Herman Daly, a professor at the University of Maryland and an expert on how human economies and natural ecosystems interact.
We live in a growth economy, but unfortunately the economy is a part of a larger system, the Earth ecosystem, which does not grow.
For decades, Daly has advocated a transition to what's called a steady-state economy, in which both human population and physical wealth are relatively stable.
It's an economy in which the path of progress is not getting bigger and bigger, more and more stuff. It's an economy in which the path of progress is to get better, to design better things.
He said it's not possible to consume more than one planet can provide.
The problem is that we've reached a point at which the value of what we're displacing and sacrificing in order to grow is greater than the benefit of the extra stuff we get from growth.
He said measures of economic growth don't factor in the costs of growth.
We just count production and consumption. We don't have any other account which talks about things that are lost as a result of growth. So we need to count the costs of growth and stop growing when the costs are rising faster than the benefits.
Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
Let's take a look at Mike Solo's forecast for Illinois and Indiana for the remainder of the afternoon. In northern and eastern Indiana, partly sunny with a few snow flurries. Elsewhere, mostly sunny with highs ranging from 15 in northwestern Illinois to 35 in the far south. Tonight in western and southern Illinois, becoming cloudy with light snow possible towards morning. Elsewhere, increasing cloudiness. Lows tonight ranging from 12 in northeastern Indiana to 27 in the far south. The outlook for tomorrow in southern sections of Illinois and Indiana, cloudy with a chance of light rain and snow. Elsewhere, cloudy with occasional light snow and flurries.